Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America.
Fifty years ago today, President Lyndon Johnson gave his first State of the Union address. It was less than 2 months after President Kennedy had been assassinated, and people might have expected a reserved theme of quiet, stay the course reassurance. But that was not for LBJ. Instead, 50 years ago, he declared war on poverty. Here is a 2.5-minute excerpt that begins with how the war on poverty was to be waged.
For the war against poverty will not be won here in Washington. It must be won in the field, in every private home, in every public office, from the courthouse to the White House. The program I shall propose will emphasize this cooperative approach to help that one-fifth of all American families with incomes too small to even meet their basic needs. Our chief weapons in a more pinpointed attack will be better schools and better health and better homes and better training and better job opportunities to help more Americans, especially young Americans, escape from squalor and misery and unemployment roles where other citizens help to carry them. Very often, a lack of jobs and money is not the cause of poverty, but the symptom. The cause may lie deeper in our failure to give our fellow citizens a fair chance to develop their own capacities, in a lack of education and training, in a lack of medical care and housing, in a lack of decent communities in which to live and bring up their children. But whatever the cause, our joint federal-local effort must pursue poverty, pursue it wherever it exists, in city slums and small towns, in sharecropper shacks or in migrant worker camps, on Indian reservations, among whites as well as Negroes, among the young as well as the aged, in the boom towns and in the depressed areas. Our aim is not only to relieve the symptom of poverty, but to cure it, and above all, to prevent it.
President Lyndon Johnson, from his State of the Union address 50 years ago today, his war on poverty has waxed and waned, was replaced by a war on welfare in the 90s. But today, in the form of Bill de Blasio, President Obama, and others, it's back. History professor Peniel Joseph is back as we continue our 50-year series with him. He's founder of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University. So far, he's been on for the 50th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech and the Kennedy assassination. Today, the declaration of war on poverty. Hi, Peniel. Thanks again for the series, and welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me.
Do you know who came up with the phrase war on poverty? Who decided to put that military frame on it?
Well, I don't know exactly who came up with the phrase war on poverty. I know that the idea of having a war economic inequality was something that predated Lyndon Johnson, of course. We had seen it in the New Deal, and Michael Harrington's book, The Other America, had come out, and it had been something that JFK was toying with, but JFK really thought he wanted to get a tax cut pushed through before the assassination. And Lyndon Johnson found out from JFK's advisors that this is one of the things that the president had been discussing before his assassination. And Johnson was an old New Dealer. He had been head of the Youth Corps under President Roosevelt. He had been the guy who was head of the National Youth Administration. And he was very, very much interested in poverty. He had taught young Mexican immigrants in Cotulla, Texas. He was familiar with rural poverty. He was familiar with people who had no electricity, who had no indoor heating, no toilets. And he was really interested in this idea of waging a war on poverty.
January 8th, 1964 would also have been the start of Johnson's election year, where he hoped to succeed Kennedy with his own elected term. Did he think in 1964 that running against poverty was good politics?
Well, you know, I think Johnson always thought about politics, no matter what he was doing, whether he was with his family, his friends, or other political leaders. But I really think that at the core of Lyndon Johnson is somebody who wanted to be a transformative president, and he connected poverty with all these other issues. You played a great excerpt over there, but what's remarkable about the speech is that he talks about immigration reform. He talks about infrastructure spending. He talks about global peace. He talks about ending our association with, plutonium reactors and sort of lessening the nuclear arsenal.
So
he talks about getting a man to the moon.
Dreaming no small dreams in the State of the Union Address of 1964.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a brilliant and very, very bold speech. And it really, 50 years later, one of the things I wrote on the route today was why we need a new war on poverty, because I think one of the great things about celebrating and analyzing these anniversaries, it really forces us to take stock in what we're doing now. The New York Times has had a series of articles on the war on poverty and sort of the reduction of the poverty rate from 19% 50 years ago to 15%, but there's still 46 million Americans in poverty, and the Senate and the Congress are debating whether to extend unemployment benefits. The President of the United States could sign an executive order to raise the minimum wage, at least in terms of people who are employed by federal contractors. So these are debates that we're still having today. So it's really important to remember 50 years ago how big and ambitious presidents and civil rights leaders were in terms of tackling these issues.
And one thing that I think has changed is that I don't think politics run against poverty explicitly anymore very much. For decades already, they've been running on behalf of the middle class, and those who aspire to be middle class is sometimes the euphemism for the poor. Do you think the politics of trying to defeat poverty have changed?
Absolutely. I think that's a very succinct analysis by you. We've substituted the poor for the middle class. The poor and working poor and even working class have suddenly become middle class. The only problem with that is because there's so many poor people, 46 million, and there's millions of children who have food insecurity, don't know where their next meal is going to be. There's millions of homeless people, too, is by not focusing utterly on poverty. And like you said, in the 90s, we waged a war on welfare and a war on poor people. We've really abandon the poor. So the poor don't have lobbyists. What the healthcare industry does, the gun lobby, there's a gun lobby, there's an oil and energy lobby, but poor people don't have effective people who are articulating on their behalf. And oftentimes, because they're poor, they don't have the wherewithal to become lobbyists and to become intellectuals, journalists, all these things themselves. So they've been really left on the margins of society, even as after the Great Recession, we have the biggest accumulation of wealth by the top 1% in American history. So we're getting back to the Gilded Age, the late 19th century, of basically the super capitalist that somebody like Theodore Roosevelt was an outspoken opponent of.
But who's the constituency for poverty? In light of what you just said, right, it's hard for poor people to have political power. But by the same token, there's no pro-poverty constituency per se. We're for poverty. Permanent poverty is not in anyone's interest, exactly, right? So how does that play itself out?
Well, there is no pro-poverty interest, but the fact that there's 46 million poor people and the gap between the rich and the poor is growing has shown us that without having a concerted anti-poverty agenda, millions of Americans get left behind. What's interesting about the State of the Union in 1964 is that Lyndon Johnson tied national and international peace to this idea of ending poverty at the local, national, and global level. So there's no pro-poverty agenda, but the pro-capitalist agenda or the pro-growth agenda has left millions and millions of people behind. The president of the United States realizes this, tried to do something about it through both the Health Care Act, the Affordable Health Care Act, which is probably the biggest anti-poverty law that we've had since the Great Society, and he's tried to do something about it through the stimulus. But there's not been corresponding job growth for people with high school degrees. They have the biggest level of unemployment in the United States. And then when it comes to African Americans, when it comes to Native Americans on reservations, when it comes to poor whites who live in predominantly rural and non-urban areas, those folks are being left behind as we speak.
We're talking with Tufts history professor Peniel Joseph, our recurring guest in our occasional 50-year history series that we started last year and will probably continue through next year through some of the 50th anniversaries of the passage of the most major civil rights acts. And listeners, we can take your phone calls as we talk about the war on poverty then and now, today being the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon Johnson's declaration of war on poverty in his State of the Union address of 1964. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. To go back to some of the history, Morning Edition did a piece on this today on NPR, which was largely about how Johnson's first big example of American poverty to push for his war at the time was Appalachia. But that was rural white poverty for the most part, while American poverty even then, I think, was disproportionately black and urban in the North, black and rural in the South. Was Johnson consciously distracting attention from the racial elements of poverty at the time, do you think?
Absolutely. Lyndon Johnson was a New Dealer, and he knew that the New Deal rhetoric of universal uplift was all well and good, but in practical application, the New Deal was two-tiered liberalism. Columbia University political scientist Ira Katznelson has a brilliant book called When Affirmative Action Was White that looks at that in real depth. When we think about him showing rural poverty in Appalachia, it was designed to show that it's not about black people, because from the 1960s to the present, if anybody talks about social welfare programs, the image that conjures for most Americans is African Americans. It's poor black people. What Lyndon Johnson was trying to say is that, no, we're all in this together. This is much more universal. And by the way, the Associated Press a few months ago had a great article on economic inequality that said that 4 out of 5 white Americans would face economic insecurity during their lifetime. So the landscape of poverty in the United States has absolutely fundamentally changed over the last 50 years.
You don't think it's still a higher risk for people of color? I saw one stat in that New York Times article that you tweeted out from the other day, Annie Lowry's piece, about the war on poverty results being a mixed bag, that 4 in 10, 40% of black children are in poverty. It's not nearly that much for white children.
Oh, certainly. African Americans experience disproportionate poverty. And the reason they do so is because since the end of slavery and then the 100 years after the system of Jim Crow, they have less access to jobs, health care, and income and wealth and good schools. So they are certainly disproportionately affected. But the new economy is starting to disproportionately affect white Americans as well. It's starting to affect them in greater numbers than has been historically shown. So when we think about poverty, poverty is disproportionately affecting African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, which the president mentioned in that speech 50 years ago, have a special kind of poverty because they're on a reservation system where there's a lot of inequity. And he mentioned that. But white Americans, it was very, very important to mention them and put them at the center so that the whole country could get behind a war on poverty and not racialize it. In that same State of the Union, he talks about ending all discrimination in the United States. And remember, The Civil Rights Act was passed on July 2nd, 1964. So he's actually doing this State of the Union 6 months before the Civil Rights Act was passed and about 45 days after JFK's assassination. So this is an extraordinary speech. And what I love about this speech, and I think President Obama and contemporary politicians could really take a great example, is how bold this speech is. The greatness of America, Martin Luther King Jr. said, lies in the right to protest for right. But the greatness of America is also the idea of tackling big problems with ambitious goals. So the idea of saying we're going to end poverty, only a truly great nation can say something like that.
Jose in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yeah, Brian, good morning. Good morning to your guests. Brian, I worked all my life here in the United States. I never seemed to raise myself or my family out of poverty. And I broke my back. I busted my hump. I applied for different services, for example, Social Security, and I get denied, right? And I see that the group of whites nothing's wrong with them, but yet they get approved. It seems for some reason that the good old boys club is still on it, and some of us are being left behind, even though we work and bust our backs, bust our balls, and we're left behind. Even we've denied it, even though we qualify and we have every right for these programs, and I don't understand it. Thank you, Brian.
Jose, thank you very much. Well, of course, we don't know his individual story and all of that, but then we hear some outrageous things. Peniel Joseph, I don't know if this made it to Boston this morning, the news about people who were New York City workers of various kinds who scammed the system to get Social Security disability payments for years related to injuries they faked after the 9/11 attack and all kinds of things. So there are undeserving people who get benefits and there are deserving people who don't get benefits.
Yeah, what's so interesting about that recent story about the firefighters and the police is that overwhelmingly it seems as if they were white. And obviously we know the FDNY as a native New Yorker growing up in the city. I know that that's been predominantly white. The police department's been more integrated as of late. What's interesting about this idea of undeserving poor, though, Brian, is that that really goes back to even before the 1960s, the 19th century, where there were poor houses. And Michael Katz has done great work on this. When we think about
the author of the book, The Undeserving Poor, which was just re-released, by the way, and updated.
Yeah, that's an absolutely classic. What's interesting is this whole idea of the undeserving poor and the underclass has been racialized. Ronald Reagan brilliantly called black women on welfare welfare queens, right? And that became a racial code for saying that welfare was something that the undeserved black poor got. So what Bill Clinton did in the 90s with the welfare reform was transform the welfare system as we know it, and you had to work to get welfare. It was block grants. You couldn't be on it in perpetuity. But that legislation put over 1 million children below the poverty line. And different activists like Marion Wright Edelman of the Children Defense Fund and others were really, really upset over that. And almost 20 years later, we see that welfare reform has really made living on a day-to-day in the United States even more challenging for millions and millions of people, including white people. So what's interesting about the corruption that we saw with the FDNY and the NYPD is that it's a different face of welfare corruption. And historically, the people who needed advocacy the most in the 60s, there was something called the National Welfare Rights Organization. And there were different welfare rights organizations that were trying to reform the system. So just what the caller had identified about unequal access, that could be somehow transformed. By the 80s and 90s, what we had, even amidst rapid unemployment and real a crisis in urban communities, the rhetoric changed to not about getting poor people access, but about why poor people weren't working in Reagan's America. So it's really remarkable. And Bill Clinton, instead of really transforming that narrative, he actually goes along with that narrative and does the welfare reform. So what's interesting is in 2014, there's a realization, including by whites, a growing realization that the American economy has fundamentally changed forever. And this whole idea of employment is really changing, especially for those with just a high school degree.
Liz in Greenwich, you're on WNYC. Hello, Liz.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering if your guest could drill down a little on the number of people, you know, under the poverty line. So I'm trying to get a sense of how many people are entrenched in poverty and how many people, say, come to this country at the poverty level, and then some programs do work for them or they don't. You know, who's getting failed by the programs that we do have, and then how do you fix it?
Yeah, the numbers right now are that there's 46 million Americans under the poverty line, but the federalized standard of poverty is something like $20,000 or $22,000 a year for a family of four. So it's actually a very low threshold. For African Americans, that number is like 20, you know, maybe 20 million. It's a huge, disproportionately high number. And then for African Americans, the ones who are earning under $35,000 a year, that's another high number. Very, very few African Americans earn over $100,000 a year in the United States right now in 2014. So basically, you have about, it'd be fair to say about 50 million Americans out of a nation of over 300 million who are living below the poverty line. And there's millions more who can qualify, tens of millions, as working poor, people who have one, two, sometimes three jobs. And because of the minimum wage, they're not making enough money to lift themselves and their families up out of poverty.
And Liz's question about which programs tend to work and which don't, do you think there's a consensus on that now after 50 years of post-war and poverty experiments?
Yeah, I think the consensus is a few things. Medicare and Medicaid are both coming out of the war on poverty, and Medicare has become sort of a middle class program that people are loath to try to get rid of. Medicaid is the version of Medicare for poor people living below the poverty line, that really provides them the little bit of health care that they've had, at least before the Affordable Care Act. The other two are going to be the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, what used to be called the Food Stamp Program. The Food Stamp Program was really energized by the war on poverty. And during the Great Recession, millions of Americans got meals because of food stamps, the SNAP program, that they otherwise would not have been able to get. And then finally, Head Start. Head Start is the program that provides federally mandated preschool education for people in poor, rural, urban areas. And it's been shown through many, many studies that children who have access to Head Start do much better in the early grades, first, second, third grade, than their counterparts who have not had access to Head Start.
So, and we see the straight line from that, which was a Johnson administration program, to the election of Mayor de Blasio, who wants to start his inequality agenda with universal pre-K.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think de Blasio is sort of taking a page out of both Lyndon Johnson and Fiorello LaGuardia and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that page that says education, and we have to invest in education at the earliest stage possible, and we're going to pay dividends on that investment. And Lyndon Johnson says the same thing. He says that, you know, for $1,000 invested in poor and unemployed people in 1964, the country was going to reap over $40,000 in benefits. And what's interesting, Brian, is that 50 years ago, he was talking during a time period where our prison system in the United States is minuscule compared to what it would become. I mean, absolutely minuscule. In 1964, there's going to be way less than a half a million people, less than 300,000 people in jail in the totality of the United States. And right now, we've got 2 million.
And on that notion of the criminalization of poverty, we leave it with history professor Peniel Joseph, founder of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University. He's going to continue to join us periodically as we look back on the momentous things that happened 50 years ago in 1964. Today is the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon Johnson's first State of the Union address, in which he declared war on poverty. Peniel, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, why the American Dialectic Association has chosen because as its word of the year. Stay with us.